To see examples of what we talk about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction. All right, today we have a special guest. He was on a couple of months ago talking about a comic book project he was working on called The Eighth. Now he's got a new project we're all excited about, and you'll hear for about it today. Let me introduce Mr. Adam Larson. Lawson, pardon. I did it again, didn't I?
It's okay. How you guys doing? It's funny about the name is that forever, I work on sets. I direct television in my day job. And one of those common names that people call me is Alan. And I'll be sometimes, weeks knowing people and I'm still Alan. So I've come to accept that whatever reason is, my name gets misheard, and I'm cool with it.
Well, I apologize for that.
My name is Al. When I was a kid one time, Albert, when I was a kid one time, I was in class and the teacher goes, so-and-so, Jimmy, Bobby, and Elmer. Everybody's looking at each other, Elmer. And I was like, Elmer? And I was like, yeah, Elmer. And then they say my last name. I go, no, it's Albert. And she's like, everybody's laughing. I'm going, thanks a lot, teacher. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Well, among the many names I've been called is Elmer, but, So, yeah. So what, you direct television? What do you direct?
Yeah, so I also write and direct to television. So they call it the television showrunner. I was showrunning, and in this case, I was also writing and directing all of the episodes, a series for the last 4 years called Escape Tonight. It's this cool fantasy horror series where a group of people go back in time to an era and they get trapped there and they have one night to get out before they're all killed.
Oh, we've seen that. Yeah. That's right. We talked about it before. That's right. So how did you come about getting into comics? Were you always into comics as a kid, or?
Yeah, so comic books were, Al, were a personal passion when I was young. I remember, the first time, because I started with Dungeons & Dragons, and I remember going into the game called the Dragon's Keep in Utah. And I remember seeing Jim Lee and Chris Claremont's X-Men cover, right? And I remember seeing Jim Lee's, take on characters. And it's what turned me on to comics. It's like, wow, these characters are cool. Look at this Cyclops, got all these muscles. He's not some geek with this thing covering his head. He's got like these sunglasses, and I shouldn't say geek, but he just looked like that's the guy I want to be, And so that started initially my passion for comics, and then it grew, from artists to writers, and then it went from Alan Moore was kind of the writer that said, wow, writers can be really amazing and important. And then it was this book, 100 Bullets by Brian Azzarello, that kind of took me from mainstream comics to Image and all the sort of indie world of comics. And so it's been a real personal passion, Al. And I've been with The Eighth and now with The Kill Journal. Both these projects have been incubating for years. And I'd always had this desire in me to be publishing comic books and board games, because I work in those. In television as well, in a crazy way. But so I had all this passion for it, and I've been creating these characters and hiring concept artists and working on stuff just around money and just around time. And then when COVID hit, I said, I can't shoot TV, and so I have this forced time where I can't work at television, and where I could dedicate everything to getting these comic books off the ground and getting this publishing company off the ground. And so I just dove in with all my heart, and fortunately I had a lot of these projects already in the work and concept work done, and so I was able to jump right in. And so that's how I crossed the line from fan to dreaming about it to doing it.
Oh, that's amazing. So when you were you must have been a kid in the 90s then, I imagine, right?
Yeah.
10 years old, 20, 15 years old or something like that. You knew of comics before, I'm sure, from the old school. Did your dad have comics or anything like that? Was there stuff running around the house or whatever?
Yeah, my dad, you know what my comics my dad still had that he showed me was The Last of the Mohicans.
Yeah.
Oh, the Classics Illustrated.
Yes. So that's what he had, and I remember loving that. You know, he didn't have any, you know, superhero-based comics. It was always it was Robinson Crusoe and Last of the Mohicans. And I, you know, I loved both of those stories so much, right? And that one, I think, was, if you're right, Al, here's the very, very first, like, image was that. And then, obviously, characters such as Superman and Batman and Spider-Man that every child knows about.
Right.
Seen, but I hadn't necessarily, you know, wasn't, you know, an avid reader.
Yeah. Were you an artist as a kid, or were you always a writer? Did you like to draw comics or anything like that, or really?
You know, I it's funny you say that, because I remember taking, I had a really good friend named Daniel Solon, who was an amazing artist, and he would always trace these Jim Lee images.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, so cool. I tried, I took a few art classes, and I was just kind of a dud at it. I wasn't a natural. And so I sort of quit early, right? And it's funny now, because I've taken a few courses on drawing now to try and improve my drawing so that I can communicate things better. But in the course of time in television, I've art directed a lot of animation and a lot of art images and taken lots of art study classes. And so my capacity to work with an artist and to know their details is quite high. But my personal art skill is not where I dream it could be.
Well, yeah, because as a writer, you have to visualize kind of a lot of what's going on, and you have to explain it, I mean, whether verbally or like with stick figures or with like loose sketches to the, I mean, do you work with, when you do television, do you work with like one of the guys that does the layouts for you? I can't think of the name, you know, the guys who do the
storyboard artist.
Storyboard, yeah, senior moment over here, yeah, storyboard. You work with storyboards?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My first graphic novel, The Eight, is drawn by my storyboard artist, Joran Evers.
Okay.
So what happened is you know, I got him on ArtStation. I started hiring him to do storyboards for me for television, really selfishly hoping he maybe wanted to do comics because I loved his style. and he really wanted to do comics and not storyboards. And so after a couple of years of working on storyboards, we said, let's do this comic book together. So, but yeah, no, storyboard artists are really key and wonderful, and they're very helpful to communicate, especially complex action sequences or something which involves visual effects, where a lot of people need to get really precise about how.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Was The Eighth, was that your first book, or was there something before that?
There was a book I co-wrote called Dead Speed with Keith Arum. And it's something, and Christopher Shai was the artist, and he and I were working on movies together, and he'd done a lot of the work, and I kind of came in later and helped co-write it and flesh out the dialogue and et cetera. And it was a first beginnings, you know, of that. But The Eighth is really my first creation, where I'm the creator of the story and the writer, and it's just, and that book is just Joran and I. You know, he does the art, and I do all the words, including the lettering. And so it's really a good mashup.
Yeah, it was a fantastic book.
Yeah, it was a really nice book. It really was. You know, I was like surprised. I was like, okay, because we see some stuff that's nice, but that one really was like, wow, that's really powerful. You know, I was wondering whether it was your first book, or if you had done some comics, indie comics before. Did the artist ever do any comics before? He was always a storyboard guy.
You know what? He had not done comics before either. And so it was like two new guys doing it. And you know, it's interesting now, because the Kill Journal, I have five artists on it. I have a main artist, and then there's four little short stories in the back of it that are six pages. They're like kind of anthology stories. And so now I've worked with a lot more artists in the comic book space, lots of them very experienced. And I realize now how much I lucked out with Joran, how much of like a gift, how naturally gifted and committed and visionary he really is. Not saying that the other guys aren't good, but you realize, wow, this guy who was his first graphic novel was having thoughts and panel designs and instincts on how to lay out the story so that it reads and communicates as well as people who've been doing it for 15 years. And so it's another testament to Joran how cool he is and how sometimes you can like you can strike gold the first time you stick the shovel in the ground.
Yeah, you're no doubt about that.
Well, I would think maybe some of that was because he was working as a storyboard artist, so he understood the sequences.
Yeah, exactly right.
And you two had worked together, so it was kind of... Because when I read The Eighth, I like... I love teams, but I really like writer-artist. That was always my favorite, still a certain point.
Sure.
Because unless they're a lazy artist and don't want to write things they don't want to draw. But I always liked that kind of vision. But there were some teams where when you have a writer... the story gets a little more in-depth, and ideas. There's a lot of ideas that I don't always see when the writer, I mean, when the artist writes it himself. When I read The Eighth, it was like one person did everything, but there was as much effort put into the art as the story, and there was a lot of wild ideas in there that it kept my interest the whole time. So, anyway, we're here to talk about your new book.
Yes, The Kill Journal. Have you guys seen the animation?
Yes.
Oh, beautiful. Wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, I know that, you know, with trying to bring a new property to life, it's tricky. And, you know, getting people excited. And so, you know, last time my opening animatic was like a little over a minute, about a minute 15. And so this one I tried to get it to like 37 seconds so I could really share the magic of what the story is and use some motion to hook people initially and to pique their interest. And I think it kind of sets the stage of what this tale is. This is essentially like a splatter movie with a conscience, right? This is a tale of people trying to cope with trauma, the fact that their friends or family have been killed by these revenants, which are something analogous to a Freddy or a Jason. And their friends have been killed or their family members have been killed. And how do they cope with this horrible trauma? They pick up weapons and go and try and hunt down these revenants, right? That's how they choose to cope, which comes with a cost, because when you hunt something that is dark and evil, it can rub off on you. And so you really have this pack of characters who are dealing with some really heavy emotional issues, all of this loss. And in some instances, some of the losses could partly be their fault. Right, that with one of the girls, Marty, you know, her dad was a chemist, lost his job. She worked with him in the basement. He started building bombs for the wrong people. He met this woman, and then she kind of faded into the background. And you know, fighting for her dad's attention, she enacted an urban myth. You know, it was supposed to be just fake, but in this mirror house in a carnival, this revenant killed her father when it was supposed to kill the woman, she had thought. And so there's this piece of guilt now that is tied into what happened that night. And so they're not only fighting the monsters on the outside, they're fighting the ones on the inside.
Yeah, that makes sense. I watched it in the animation, and it was like, I want to read the comic book, but man, I want to see that as a cartoon or whatever. When I saw the characters moving and all that, I was like, this looks really cool, man. I'd like to see this as like a, you know, episodic thing too or whatever. You know, I guess that's just, maybe that's something you might have in mind in the future, possibly, I don't know. But it looked really cool. It sells it, man.
Well, thank you, dude. I really appreciate it. Well, look, I want to show you something that I think will be fun here. Let me just show you this. This is for something else, but it's where we're going with everything. And so I can get to kind of show you what we have in the works. Let me just show you this.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Oh, nice. Oh yeah.
That is nice.
Oh, that's real nice.
Wow.
That's amazing. Oh yeah.
So that's kind of where we're going with things. There's going to be another minute added to that. So we're trying to get things into the animated world as well. Because I think, you know, when building a publishing company and when building comics, it's, you know, the idea of getting it into an animated world is so exciting because it can bring a lot of light and attention to the property so that you can build new fans for the graphic novel, and also to the success of the animation. But it's a way to bring a spotlight when it's hard to get people's attention, right?
It kind of grabs you, because you see all these projects and stuff like that, and you're like, okay, that's nice, the drawing's nice, but when you see it come into life, it's like, that's a little bit different. That's something else is going on here, you know what I mean? It's like moving at you. So how is it working with Indiegogo? Two questions. How is it working with Indiegogo, and do you have any intentions of going into comic shops, or are you in comic shops? Yeah. I haven't seen your books in comic shops.
So to answer your question, yes and yes. So Indiegogo has been working out great. I chose Indiegogo just because that's what I had done on my TV show Tabletop, which was a celebrity board gaming show. We'd use that to launch one of the seasons. And, after it was once a Google show, and then it got cut, and then we launched a third season on our own. And so that I kind of become familiar with the platform, and it's worked out great. And so I think what's going to happen, or not, I think what the plan is, Al, is so the 8th will be fully finished at the end of this year, all 8 of the issues, and it's going to go to print, and it'll become a hardcover slipcase for those people who have backed it on Indiegogo. But then we're also going to take that to distributors, so that we can get it into comic book shops and also into traditional bookstores. Yeah. I think in many ways, I think a lot of the future of comics is, can you get your comic book into a Walmart? Can you get it into places that are more highly trafficked? In some ways, you see that, you see Alliance Comics are now in Walmart after they've had no comics in 20 years in Walmart. And you feel like that maybe the future of comic books is maybe less also to the floppies and with maybe more graphic novels in some way, because if you're not a collector, Al, that, there's something nice about having this, right?
Your hands. Yeah.
That's right, in your back. It's a full story. It can stand up. You can collect it, right? You seldom see, when you look at people's collections, they're often showing you their trades, seldom their floppies, right? And so part of me wonders if more of the future of it is trades and mainstream distribution. Not that we wouldn't want to do floppies, please don't say that, think that, but that but that's our destination. So early next year, when the book comes in, then we're going to head out for solicitation to distributors to find a partner, whether it be Diamond or whoever it ends up being, to get it into stores. And so that's but we're wanting, so we need to at least have book one, to get,
to
pick it up. And then we would and then the same thing with the Kill Journal. And that's why we have actually another project coming out in early next year that will be like February, March. We have another graphic novel so that we can build up a library so that we become appealing to a distributor so it can get into more hands.
If you can get into Barnes and Noble or whatever, that would be a nice one too. Yeah, because when Don and I were kids back in the Stone Age, used to have comic shops, used to have 7-Elevens. Everywhere you went, there was a comic book.
Grocery stores, yeah.
It was entertainment for kids. Obviously, it was really cheap. They're not that cheap now, but they're made for different, all different levels or whatever. And I think you're right about being more like graphic novels. Just read the whole thing, and then you enjoy it, and then whatever. For the people that want separate issues, I guess you could do that too. But I don't know if that's the way to go anymore. Too much competition too. I don't know.
Right, and I think it's because also too the floppies have reached a price point where there's one thing when it's 25 cents or it's a buck or it's a buck 25, you can grab a handful of them and
exactly.
But now when it's $4, or sometimes even $5, it starts to become cost prohibitive for something that feels kind of disposable.
Exactly.
And it's disposable for somebody who's not a comic person, I should say, right? And which is, part of the mission, right, is to attract people who might not be the man or woman who's always who's at the local comic shop, right? Whereas the trade feels more like a book. It feels more like, when you pay for it, it feels more substantial. These are just my thoughts, and it seems to be what I kind of get echoed by other people and publishers. But yeah, that's the plan. So hopefully, Kill Journal, which will be complete around February, March next year. And as far as its print run, which we're super excited about, that's our plan. And the Kill Journal is a cool story because we're actually going to do it's going to be a leather bound book.
Nice.
With a cool design, and it's going to feel, because the Kill Journal is essentially in the story, there's this character, St. George, and he is this sort of half-mad preacher who is the one who's rallied the people to the cause, right? He believes he's been divinely called to, like, to end these revenants. And so he has got he's taken this old Bible and filled it with these loose pages, and, like, sort of keeps track of all the revenants they kill and all the information they find. It's like his record, right? It will become their Bible, their history. And so when you get the graphic novel, it is that book that's in the comic. So it'll have the same design and leather working that the character uses in the comic. So it's kind of like that you've gotten his that you're reading the Kill Journal he's writing. So it'll be cool. So it'll be a different take, and I think that's one fun thing about Indiegogo is you can offer things like that. Because you don't have to deal with the retailer taking half, and so you can offer that kind of cool item at a price point you couldn't normally get. And so it's going to be a cool leather bound edition, kind of like the Eighth was a hardcover with a slipcase. This would be a leather bound edition. It'll also do the digital issues like I did with the Eighth, where you get the digital issues after the campaign ends. You start getting issue one and two, and so forth. And then this one will also be cool because it has a mask, one of the Revenant masks, which I gave away one for free last month to somebody on the pre-launch page, and I'm giving another one away to a day one backer. They're a cool, like, fiberglass resin mask that's the real thing, and you look like the coolest person at your Halloween party.
Yeah, because I saw with Indiegogo, like, I remember watching some guy selling, you know, doing the Indiegogo on Facebook, and the more money that you got, the more perks you would get, right? Sometimes it was
original art,
and sometimes it was statues. I mean, it would go, you know, gradually more and more or whatever. So it was kind of like piques your interest a little more. You know? Are you doing artwork? I mean, is your art done on paper,
so,
or is it done digitally?
Okay, so it's a mix of things. So so with the Kill Journal, so the way it's working out, there's an 88-page central story, so a 4-issue central storyline, and then there are 4 6-page stories in the back. Mm-hmm. And the 6-page stories are the origins of our 4 hero characters, because I find that origin stories chunked into the main story end up kind of bogging it down. Mm-hmm. And so we can focus on the storyline, and then after you read and experience the story, then it's fun to kind of go back and be like, oh, what happened to that character. So it's going to be over 112 pages of, you know, panel work, and then add, you know, 16 pages of cover in there. And so you're getting 128-page awesomeness. Well, that's the hope. So the plan is the stretch goals for us are, you know, the first 4 stretch goals are these little anthology stories that go in the back.
Okay.
And so those will be our stretch goals. We also have, for all the week one backers, we have this really cool free print. And I can show you this awesomeness. Let me see if you're, I can give you a little, I can show you this guy here. So this is a cool free print that's going to come to all the backers.
Oh yeah, that's nice. Oh yeah.
And so this is an artist named Preston Acevedo, and the colorist is Mike Spicer, who did Murder Falcon and Extremity. I don't know if you follow Daniel Warren Johnson's work, but he's a pretty amazing colorist.
It's really and strong so, color.
Yeah, it's great, right?
Oh yeah.
And so so that's a print that's going to go out to all the week one backers. And then we have the 4 stretch goals there, and then we have a few other things that we have, I would say, in the question mark land. If we break through those 4 stretch goals, there'll be more stuff to come. And so that's what we're working on. There's obviously, you know, there'll be certain these things that'll probably fall into, you know, sticker land with some of our hero characters. But we like to do things that are maybe less just a print or a sticker with the stretch goals. We want to kind of make them embellish the story or the book more. At least I feel like for myself, the stretch goals I end up liking the most are the ones that enhance the project itself. if that makes sense.
Yeah. Something that moves the story along or gives you something different that you want. Yeah, I get it. Now, do the artists themselves draw digitally, or do they draw on paper? How do you get the artwork? How do you work on it? You know, the technical aspects of it.
How does that work technically? So my main artist, Raymond Bermudez, who's doing the 88 pages. So what is happening is he draws digitally, but I can show you what his lines look like. They're fairly, it's kind of crazy. I think it's all done digitally because of how fresh it looks. Let me show you this real quick. You can see his lines. And I think the reason people tend to draw digitally so much is just by virtue of speed and the ability to make correction.
Yeah.
And so here he...
Nice.
So here an inked page that comes in from Raymond. But it feels very hand-drawn. And it's because he does some hand-drawn stuff initially. Like his roughs are hand-drawn, and then he puts them in the computer and goes from there. But this is his, he's an amazing artist. He has great composition, obviously, in the sense of action and emotion. And so he's working, he's doing the inks digitally. And then my colorist, Oliver, he's also working digitally. And then I letter it digitally as well.
Oh,
wow.
But a couple of our artists who are working on some of the anthology stories don't work that way. Maxi Dallo was doing one of our stories. He's a full traditional artist, traditional pencils, traditional inks, and then we color it digitally. And then also, as far as so he will be working traditionally on the storylines, but generally speaking, it ends up going digitally just by virtue of speed and ability to make revisions. But also to that print I just showed you, the Kill Journal one that was all in like a cool pink and the cap with all the models. That the line art for that was all done traditionally, and that will be something that somebody can buy. It will be because it was done, full hand drawn inked experience that then I digitally colored.
Sweet. Now this is better than all the stuff that I see on the stands when I go to the comic shop. I was like, this artist is amazing. He worked for Marvel? He worked on Wolverine?
Yeah, so he had been doing cover work for Wolverine for a while, and and he's somebody I had hired in the past to do some work on a game for me, it was a tabletop game, and he had done a bunch of work, and I just loved what he does, because it's so, right, it's this sort of really organic feeling to it, and the way he uses the lines to create the detail and emotion. And he just does something very special, and it feels real what he does, and so hence why I reached out to him to do this book, and he has been working away like mad to do it.
It's easy to read too.
The sequence,
it's easy to read, even with no words. The sequences, it just kind of flows, which is important. It's really strong.
Yeah. Don, you and I have talked about it before. The importance, the layout, right, and the way. You know, what actually happens in the panel and how they're laid out for an audience to understand and emotionally experience the page, right? And I feel like Raymond and I are a pretty good match of that ability, right? To build the content of the panel and the way they're laid out to take you through it, right? Like when you look at this page here, the girl's attacked, then she's lifted. This guy in the shadows sees it. He ignites for rage. This other girl here who is at the... who you saw in the first panel there in panel 5 then reaches for this bomb and lights it, and so it all kind of syncs itself together. But here's another cool page that's done traditionally here, so you can see this one. This is a traditional page. So this art here for the week one print, that was all done traditionally in their art lines. It's all done on paper. So it's pretty rad, to when I think about that, when I think about a guy doing that with inks and pencils, and like you realize that, there was no ability to just, undo that. That is what it is, right?
It is what it is, yeah. There's no room for mistakes.
One thing about the color I mentioned, this is a really nice drawing. Comic coloring really improved when computers came in. But at the same time, sometimes the restraint was lost. And sometimes, a dark horse, this is one. I loved Barry Smith's Conan work he did for Marvel back in the 70s. When Dark Horse printed them, the line work was kind of muddy. You know, the colorist wasn't paying attention, and they kind of went crazy with it. Oh, that's nice, too.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the color work you're showing on these, on this print and this page, it hasn't destroyed the line work. It's just as nice, but the colors, they're not flat colors. They're modeled. They're there. The print you're talking about, I was impressed around that main character's neck, how he had the shadows lifted, but it's not taken away from the artwork. It's just enhancing what you've already got. It's the color work is really, really strong on fantastically drawn images.
Thank you. So you can see that page here. So this is a color digitally. And I agree with you. Digital coloring has done so much for what a colorist can do versus traditionally, and also too with just the time and significantly. But just the gradients and the distressing and the things that you can put into a digital color. This is Oliver, and I love what he's done by, you know, if you see this in this bits of this action on these panels, he's added this bright orange, right? This gradient orange that, like, you know, it makes this scene feel like it's exploding, right? Because the page right before it, it's kind of, the room is kind of dark and moody, and then boom, it explodes with this orange as this attack happens, right? To help communicate the sensation of surprise. And the way what Oliver does, which I really like, is you can see these characters in the background here. Yeah, they look kind of like ghosts, right? They're just like this kind of this bluish gray coloring to, like, put your focus on the center of the action, but to keep, you know, the characters in the story. And I think it's a really nice choice, because it helps tell the story, but also still keeping all your characters in frame that are supposed to be there.
Oh, no, this page looks really nice. Yeah, no doubt about it.
I like it without color. I like it with color. Really strong. Go ahead, Al.
You got to send us some of these images to put on our Facebook for our pages or whatever, because that'll sell the book right there.
On the blog.
These pages will sell the book, no doubt about it. Have you written any of this yet, or this is all?
Yeah, so it's written. So all these pages are real pages to script. So the way it works out in my process is I write the script, and it's a fairly detailed script about panel and content and all the dialogue and all the VO, all the sound effects. I write a very thorough script, and that gets given to the artist. So any art you're seeing is coming from a script, and I'm ahead of the artists in scripts. So we have more than half the book written, and we're almost done with page one. Sorry, with issue one. We're a little past page one, but we're almost done with issue one. And so, with the idea that we'll be probably more than halfway through the book by the time the campaign ends, so people can, you know, start getting them, and then we'll be ahead of you, and so people can get them monthly. So, yeah, so I think that, you know, sometimes it can get, I think there's also to a process of writing, right, that it's like where you need time to make your writing amazing, the same way artists need time to make the art amazing. And so I'm always writing well ahead of them, so I have time to rewrite, check, you know, pass it to a few other readers to improve it, right? Because once a writer artist gets going, you can't be saying, hey, you know, this page, can we rework this? It's not very fair to them. And so you need to have done your due diligence first, right? Where you have beat your script into the ground before you hand it to an artist.
Well, he'll give you like a page, well, for lack of a better description, a pencil page, and you could say like, that's fine, or you say him, change this face to face another direction, or this is...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so that all comes in. So we get a rough space first, where it's very loose, not a lot of detailing, but to really help confirm the layout. You know, like if you looked at that page, if you look at this page here, you know, you look at this page here, it's like you see that on the right-hand side, this is St. George. He's looking in, he sees this revenant stabbing this woman. On the left-hand side, this is Marty, and she's reacting to it.
Yeah.
And so in the roughs, I'll see all of this laid out, but maybe a person has a different action or emotion, and I'll help correct that. Or maybe the angle in the rough is communicating the wrong thing, right? Like, let's say, you know, for example, you see this panel here, panel four, with Finch's face where he's like come alive. He's like the animal in him is alive, right? Maybe that shot initially in the rough was too far away from his face, right? But really what this panel is about is this emotion, right? And so I would say to Raymond, hey, Raymond, let's get that in just really tight on his face so that we can see the individual teeth, right? And we can see his eyes bugging out, because that's what the story of this panel is, right? Yeah. So I think that's always my question, is not to the artist, hey, can their chin be slightly this or that? I think that's maybe the wrong way to art direct, especially because, you know, these artists, they know how to draw. Like, I'm not going to tell them how to draw, you know, they know how to draw. But are they drawing the right thing? The right, you know what I mean? And is that panel telling the story?
No,
you see here panel two here, you see there's this guy running away here in the corner. I added this guy after we started to work on the panel, because I was like, how do we create this sensation of desperation, right? For these people, because they're afraid. And you know, these guys are in the background running away, but if we had this guy tucked into the corner here, because the way he's tucked in between the two panels and the look in his eyes, it creates this sense of fear and hiding that I think broadened the emotion of this panel.
Yeah, it's easy to follow, even with no words. You can, and I'm going to say this, I'm seeing a page to a story I haven't read yet, but I can see all the stuff you're talking about, and it's extremely easy to follow. I don't have to think about it when I'm reading it.
Yeah, plus on the page, you usually, not always, but a lot of times you really do want a dramatic close-up just to balance, just to give it a design element or balance the page so it's not all full or medium figures. You want a close-up with a face to show the emotions, and then you can have all the other panels showing all the action or whatever, depending on what the story is for that, you know, page or whatever. But it looks fine. So you add the word balloons after... Okay, so you have a program that gives you word balloons to be able to mix and match and put out. Do you have an actual letterer that does that for you?
No, I letter it. I do all the effects and I do the speech balloons, you know, the thought boxes, and all of the sound effects. And so there's two ways to go about it. I use two programs. One is a program called Clip Studio. That's what Jorani did all of the 8th in, and so it's just easier to do my lettering in that program, because his he sends me the raw Clip Studio files, and so it's just easier for me to work in that than it is to like export the TIFF someplace else. And so I do that, and then there's other program called Comic Life 3. It's this kind of small cheap app, though a lot of letterers work in Illustrator, but this app is just a $15 program, but the speed at which you can letter in it, because see, when you use Illustrator is not built for lettering comics. It's what people use to letter comics, so it's a really powerful, heavy program that has a steep learning curve and has lots and lots of options, which lettering requires not, you know, the what Illustrator can do, it only needs about that much of, right? Just the tiniest amount. So this program, you can letter even faster, and then if I need something specifically drawn, I can do it in Clip Studio, or I can do it in Photoshop, and then import that sound effect. But also to lots of the smaller sound effects, it can handle in there, because you can distort texting, and you can do lots of the functionality of a Photoshop to help your sound effects. And then as far as word balloons, what's cool about it is it automatically shrinks and adjusts the text as you shrink the balloon, and none of them do Illustrator or Clip Studio, so you can just move faster, and yet you can't perceive the difference. Let me show you a page here, done in both, and then you can export it. And what you have to do though with Comic Life, from a technical standpoint, because it's using an RGB format, and in InDesign, which is where I do lay out all the comics, And the way you build it ready for the print or ready for the digital, you build it all in InDesign. Because the way it does gradient RGBs, they don't translate into InDesign. So you have to export PDF, flatten your PDF first, and then import it into InDesign to preserve the sound effects. So that's a real technical thing.
Hey, we used to work graphic design. We know InDesign, yeah. Illustrator, Photoshop, and all.
Okay, so you know it well, but you know what I'm saying, yeah. Is that Illustrator, yeah, is a bulky program, right?
Yeah.
To do something, you know, to making balloons and boxes is about that much of what Illustrator can do. But let me show you this here really quick.
Yeah, Clip Studio used to be called Manga Studios.
That's right. That's
right. I didn't know that.
Yep. Same company. It's just more.
Yeah, they just ended up, changing the name of it so that it could be more.
So it's more universal as opposed to Manga.
Yeah, because it can do anything. It can do really anything. So this is, let me do this. So this is, I just, because sometimes I'll letter the black and white. Just the line art, just to get ahead of it, and also to help if the artist and I are talking about where things are going to lay out. So you can see here, this is a page from a different artist. This is Jason Krager, who's doing one of the anthology stories.
Nice.
I just did a test page with him, and so I lettered this out, so he and I could talk about just how the page was going to all feel and move. And so I did this in Comic Life, and then but you could see like a little click, I could build all of that very, very easily. It needs some tweaking on this. This was just sort of done in a few minutes, but it's really effective on building and what looks exactly like a professional comic.
Yeah, and your lettering placement is really strong. When you're talking about pasting these, I was kind of concerned, like, well, okay, but this, it just goes with the story. It doesn't mess up the artwork. That's quite nice. Go ahead, Al.
No. I was just looking at it and going like, well, that works fine. I mean, it's like you're not obscuring anything important. The word balloons go where it should be, you know?
It looks nice.
Yeah.
I mean, do you keep the same uniform size of text throughout the whole page, or there's sometimes it's small? I mean, the word balloons, not the effects, are the word balloons the same size? I mean, the text and stuff, are they different, changing?
No. So the way this works out, to get real technical with it, what the font I'm working with here is called Lint McCree International. Mm. I like it better than maybe like Blambot. I think it's an easier read. It's a very commonly used font as well. And that's at a 6-point font there, okay, on the sizing. And I use the same for the dialogue boxes, for the thought boxes or VO boxes, as well as I do in the balloons. And so I don't change the font size unless there's maybe an extreme moment, maybe somebody's screaming, right? Yeah. And I might, have it burst through the bubble or do something like that. So I would do that, or if you are going to, maybe if you can see in this top right corner, so it says fairy tales and nightmares, I bolded the nightmares. Mm-hmm. Then I'll bold and italics certain words to help enhance the meaning throughout it as well. But I try to not lean too heavy on that, so it doesn't come so, here's what I'm saying, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not telling them a reader how to feel it. But then I'm subtly noting things that I think help speak to the emotion of it. And you can see, and I try to keep it, I think that there is a magic to good lettering, as far as like the ease of reading it, the way it moves around the page, the way it doesn't cover up the key pieces of the art. Also, too, one thing I don't love is tails on balloons. Sometimes people do these longer tails, mm-hmm. kind of like long tail. I really try to avoid those. I mean, it's one thing if you see here in this panel, right here, you can see that, she's going to talk here, right? And then daughter's going to interrupt with this, but she's going to pick it up here, right? And so you need these, unfortunately, longer tails just by virtue of mechanics, right? So people can understand. And I stretched this tail a little longer so that we don't miss this cabin here.
Right.
And probably in the final, I'll move it over a little bit to keep that cabin a little bit more seen, because that's where they're going to. But this is, you know, this is how it comes in. So this, you know, so Jason in this instance gave me a traditional rough, which then he then digitally did the line work for. It's going to go to this woman named Miriam Yosfer in Cairo. She's going to color it. And she'll send me back colored, and I'll just literally swap out the black and white line art with the color, and so my lettering stays on top. And once again, it's about, I think, getting ahead on it, right? Mm-hmm. It's about an opportunity for you to sit with it for a second, which is why I start lettering as soon as possible, so you can start to think, well, you know, actually, if I moved that over a little bit, it would help. And you know what? Now that I've read this for the seventh time, I see it would be better to read it just like this, right? So I realize that that's a key part of the creative process, and I think that creative geniuses, what makes them great is that they do it a lot of times. Like Quentin Tarantino, his screenplays, I think he's the best writer in film, but his scripts are reread and reread and reread and reread, and he has theater groups come in and read them with him. He has key actors that he brings in. He does table reads. He works them to a point that very few are willing to do. And I think is he a genius? Yes. But is his process really intense? Yes. And I think that sometimes those are really connected. But to bounce back to, you know, our world of the Kill Journal, is, you know, essentially what we have is we have a horror story, right? And you can see kind of it mounting here in this single page, right? That this is a revenant that has come back. And in this case, this revenant was betrayed by his brother to this voodoo cult. He was buried in the swamps and killed, and then a year later came back. And in our world of revenants, these are evil spirits back from the dead, bent on revenge, and they continually relive the night that made them and go about killing and slaughtering those connected to it, and obviously anyone in their path. And so what's cool is each of these revenants has their own mythos to them, that the survivors club, the people who are hunting them, have to uncover, and they've got to learn the secrets of that origin, because that's how they have to then build a trap to kill them, right? Because you can't just kill a revenant by shooting them, because they come back, because they're an evil spirit inside this body, right? And they'll just keep on coming back. And, you know, in the Halloween or the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, they just keep coming back for the sequel because you haven't killed them in the proper way. And so in the way that, you know, Jason Voorhees has to be taken to Camp Crystal Lake and drowned because that's where he was initially bullied as a kid, these revenants, you have to find out that story and recreate it in some way to finally end them. For example, one of the revenants that they're working with, they're battling early on, is a revenant who loved a girl that was out of his league. He was a high school kid. The girl's dad hired a couple heavies to rough him up, to have him to stop dating his daughter. The heavies went too far and killed him, chained him to a tree, left him in the woods. The crows came and picked away his flesh. A year later, he comes back for revenge, right? Well, for them to kill this guy, ultimately they're going to need to discover this story, you know, piece together the mystery of this while avoiding getting killed and trying to save lives. And then they need to get that kid, they need to find the story. Oh, he was taken on prom night, so they've got to go back to prom, and then they've got to get him back to this tree, and they have to, you know, build, so to speak, a ritual to defeat these revenants. So it's really an engaging horror story that has this mystery and gumshoe detective aspect of it too, while there is these great moments of action. And then with each of these revenants, they're a bittersweet tale, right? Because they have something about them was redeeming beforehand, and usually they're a victim of circumstances or society in some way, and as a result there is a little bit of a bittersweet aspect to them, where you hate them, but in some ways you can in part understand them. You know, with this Revenant I was talking about, little does anybody know, is that he had gotten this girl pregnant before that prom night. And so later they find this girl, but she has a child now, and you know, the Revenant returns to see his child, but is now this terrifying killer. And so we've layered lots of depth into it so that that the struggle isn't so, oh, that's a blatant bad guy, we're good guys. And then our good guys sometimes make choices that make them a little like the bad guys. So we have, you know, one of our characters, Finch, he is a kid who grew up on the Mexican border. His dad was ran dog fighting pits. And one day a dog didn't show and he threw his kid in the ring and he killed that pit bull. And then his dad trained him like one of the dogs. And then the Revenant came in and wiped everyone out and he got free. And so he has this very animal side. That's the kid here in the red hoodie on that other image.
Yeah.
So he, this is Finch, you know, here in the red hoodie, and you can see like the animal ignites in him, yeah. Right? Like he's calm and quiet, and he treats the club like his pack, you know, like any dog, really, to the pack. They're loyal and kind, but anybody outside of it, boom, the animal comes out, right? And he's struggling with the reality that maybe someday he could become a Revenant himself, right? He has kind of the makings of it. And he even steals a Revenant mask and keeps it buried in the woods, right? And it's this bits of growing evil in him that he's contending with. So this is the world of the Kill Journal. So it's complicated horror. It's horror with a conscience. It's horror that isn't so cleanly black and white. But I think maybe that's what makes it so exciting to be a part of. And with this art and this color work and in a comic format, you get to enjoy it, I think, in one of the best ways possible to enjoy entertainment.
Now, this is going to be a graphic novel, right? Or is this going to be...
Yeah, that's right.
This isn't going to be serialized as 4 comic books or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so the way it works out is, the way I do it is, so it's like a collected trade. There'll be 4 inside it. Yeah. They'll have covers, and then, you know, and then everybody backs it digitally, gets issue 1, 2, 3, 4 each month. And then it'll be a collected experience. But instead of trying to sell, you know, each issue, there's just the graphic novel of it. But it has 4 natural breaks in it.
Now, how do you find this? I'm good for everybody that's listening so they can go out and buy it. I mean, as a matter of fact, I have 2 questions. But how can you find it? And then it's obviously there's a campaign going on now, right? When does that end? At what point? And then when does the book come out?
Yeah, so here's the story. So right now, if you go to Indiegogo and you look up The Kill Journal, and also to, I can send you a link here, Don, that you can post. People, and I'll send you all the art and links so you have it all, Don.
Oh, thank you.
But if you go to Indiegogo right now, you can sign up for the pre-launch page. And everybody who signed up for the pre-launch will get notified day 1 when the campaign goes live, and it goes live September 29th, and then you can start buying it then. But if you sign up for the pre-launch, you're going to get cool free art, and your name gets put in the drawing to win another one of those cool Revenant masks, which are $250 masks that we're giving away for free.
Wow.
And so there's a cool part about being signed up. And that's what's going on in regards to for right now. So you go to Indiegogo, The Kill Journal, sign up for the pre-launch, and then on the 29th, the campaign is live, and you can buy the graphic novel.
Right on. The campaign will go on for what, a month, 2 months, 3 months, or something like that? Or
yeah, it goes on for 30 days. So... you know, come on in while the water's warm.
And then you expect these books to be in people's hands by next year, early next year, or something like that, or
either March next year is
okay.
And
the first issue.
Oh no! So imagine the first issue will go into people's hands digitally after
digitally
the
after the campaign. Okay, all right, I got it. Okay,
collected graphic novel, the hard print, hard copy print version. March next year.
Okay, so you're gonna get it as a digital, and then at the end when everything's done, boom, you're gonna get the real. You're gonna get the one you put in your hands and read whatever you want to read it. Okay, I got it.
Exactly. And for some people, you know, some of the people may say, "Great, I'm gonna ignore the digital issues because I just want to hit it when it's in print."
Yeah.
But it's a way to stay connected after the campaign, instead of we have this campaign and then all of a sudden we're dark and silent. You don't hear from us for 6 months, right? That you actually can tap into the story world that you were initially excited about. So,
you know, it's beautiful, man.
Yeah, it is beautiful. When you're talking about, you know, March of next year, it sounds like a long time. But when I'm looking the kind of work, all I'm thinking, oh man, that's a short window.
I know, right?
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And because it's, you know, one person doing coloring, one person doing art, they can only go as fast as this, you know, as one hand can draw, as you guys both know, being artists, the time it takes to do great work. We're working furiously. I'm on it all day, every day, giving art direction notes, constantly lettering, working with the colorist, and because I'm, you know, also the overall editor of the book as well. And so I oversee every little detail, and so it's cool.
I have a question on that. You know, we're all going through isolation in different phases. Is that increased everybody's productivity with these projects, or has it hurt it?
You know, I think in some ways it's been helpful. I think that people are, I mean, artists are already kind of reclusive a little bit sometimes,
right,
in the first place. But I feel like that, in some ways that it's opened up people to communicate more through podcasts, streaming, et cetera, and connecting with people they wouldn't normally. Like, I've found a whole bunch of new friends online that I never would have had, you know, otherwise.
Right.
And so I think it's opened up kind of a new world. And I really like that. And I feel like, you know, also too, from a crowdfunding standpoint, it's a fun thing now to do, because you can crowdfund something and you can get the updates and you kind of can participate with the community. This is another cool page that's the aftermath of that fight. and you can tell that, you know, there is dealing with the drama of it all, right? That there is, it's not just action to action, it's dealing with the emotional arc of it all.
And it just flows. It just, the reading just flows, even with no words. Nice.
Now, is this going to be, okay, so it's going to be sent to you digitally after the campaigns, or are you going to get all four issues, and when you, after the fourth issue is done, you're going to get the physical copy of it. And then if you ordered other, you know, things, you'll get those, the mask, and you'll get whatever the, you know, the things are that you're offered for. You have different tiers, right? You have a basic tier, you have a tier with other things too, or is that how it works, or?
Yeah, so the way we have, there are three tiers that people can get in on. And so the first of those tiers is just the digital issues, $15, you get just the digital issues. And for some people, that's what they're in it for. And then for $40, you get the leather bound graphic novel and the digital issues. And then for $200, you get the graphic novel and you get the Revenant mask.
That's very reasonable.
Yeah.
That's extremely reasonable.
Yeah, well, that's what we felt like, is, you know, we need to be priced competitively to what people can get in a store, right, in a comic book shop, versus sometimes people are charging $25 for a 56-page graphic novel and it's $10 in shipping. And it's like, wow, you paid $35 for 56 pages. No, there's anything wrong with that, because, you know, it's hard as an indie person to get money and to get enough backers. But we wanted to try and price it at a place where you felt like this is a sweet deal. You know what I mean? That not just that you're helping out an artist, but you actually got a fair deal.
Oh, yeah, you're priced to move. You're priced to move. Yeah.
Are these characters at all, or is this a different universe from the other book?
So this is a different universe from the other book. One thing, I'll give you the super secret tip that's in the works, is we have a trading card game in the works, a collectible trading card game, a la something like Magic the Gathering, where each of these worlds is going to have their own set. The same way Magic the Gathering had different sets, you know, from the Arabian Nights, the Legends, the Antiquities. This trading card game will also work in that way, where there'll be cards from the Kill Journal, cards from the Eight, cards from Kids and Monsters, the next one. And so that is in the works. And so that will be a way where their universes will get to come together.
Okay, wow. You put a lot of thought into this.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a lot going on here. You know, it was like, wow, that's pretty amazing what can be done independently. This is better than most of the, or as far as I'm concerned, all the Marvel comics that are coming out these days.
Well, thank you. I feel like that's what I hopefully we can offer in an indie comic. And if you're somebody who loves the big two, and there's nothing wrong with that, I think what's special is that what we're offering is a chance for different characters, different art, different styling. That, not that what Marvel and DC are doing is bad or good or whatnot, but this is just something different. And it's a chance to connect to creators who are truly pouring their heart into every bit of it, that are in it for the love of the game, right? And I think there's something special to that. You know, my guy who built my mask, like, he's working at Michael's on the night shift, stacking boxes and then building masks during the daylight.
Yeah.
This is true punk rock, right? This is, this is punk rock. These are artists who are truly creating for the love of the game, versus maybe working for a Fortune 500 company.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, no doubt about it. You can see the effort that's put in by you and all the other people involved in it. You know, you can tell. You know, I was like, I like the other one, the book that you did, but this one I like a little bit better, because it's more horror, and I'm really digging the art. I'm really digging that art. That's really sweet.
I was surprised he'd done another one. that, you know, I mean, seriously, because I knew the Eighth was still going on, and now what Al's saying, that is, I was impressed seeing this now. I'm really excited about it. But I was kind of hoping to be more work like the Eighth originally. I do like the fact that it's got my interest, but it is completely different than the other one. But yeah. I'm kind of wondering what you're going to call us about in another month, and it's going to be another project.
We have another one.
I knew you did.
But for the Eighth, for the Eighth, the good news is, if you're a fan of the Eighth, you're awesome. And you know, consider what's coming out is you know, it's a complete story, but we're going to do more in the world of the Eighth. We're not finished with that universe. So,
nice.
And thank you guys so much for having me on and, you know, talking about this book and my crazy adventures in the land of comics. You guys are awesome, and I love that, you know, you guys come from the world of graphic design and art yourselves, and so you get what it is to create art and how intense it is.
Oh yeah, it's extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult to do comic book art.
Labor intensive, yeah. But it's a lot of strong work. I'm actually shocked that, you know, I see this all the time. There is a lot of work. It's just, how do you find it? You know, music, again, your shows. When you reached out to us, I looked up Escape the Night, and I'm like, wait a minute, where has this been? Now, when we talked about your game shows, Rook has seen them. One of the guys that does the show with us, he's familiar. He's watched them before.
Great.
Yeah, Rook's a gamer, you know, besides a comic guy. But when we talked about the stuff, he was talking about it. But to me, there's a lot of stuff under the radar that is out there that I'm completely unaware of now. But, you know, it finds its way at some point.
It does. Yeah,
we really appreciate you showing us the stuff and being on the show just as much as, you know, because this is what we're all about, you know, new stuff. Oh, wow, that's a gross cover.
Yeah, that's on the link you sent to us.
I sent you a link here in the chat that has all these. So these are some of these pinup images that were early concept images that were done.
Ooh, boy.
Amazing artist, Tauntaun Revolver is his name, and that he helped really craft these characters early on. He and I spent months poring over every tiny detail of these characters and their look. But this is This is one of those. There's, in that link I sent you, there's a whole list of these, of each of the characters, main characters.
This book is not for kids.
Yeah, this is more extreme than most of the pages of the book, but this is kind of a shock and awe image for sure.
Yeah, it sure looks like it. Oh, wow, that's nice.
All right, well, is there anything else you'd like to finish with?
No, I think that's it, other than, hey, guys, come on out. It's awesome. It's exciting to be involved with an indie creator and to get to share the journey. We're going to give you our hearts in these books. We're going to give you the best of what we have. And we're going to give you, also community, a connection to us directly. And I think that's something special that not everybody gives, where you get to connect directly. When people send emails and ask questions on the Indiegogo, it comes to me personally. When they shout me out on Twitter about something, I'm responding. So we're in it with you. So come on out, the water's warm.
Well, that's exactly, you're doing exactly what they did with Marvel. You want to communicate to the reader. You want, hey, come on over. We got some good stuff for you. And that's how you gain a following and a public, and that and doing some great work. Thank you for coming on. This is great. The Kill Journal on Indiegogo. You all need to go on there and grab a copy.
Yeah, check out the blog. All the stuff we talked about will be on there, along with links to Adam's other projects.
And you're going to send us like art so we can put it on the
A link in the chat, and you can it'll have a lot of these images I've been showing you. It'll be in there.
All right, great. We appreciate your time, man. That's awesome, and stay safe out there with all the.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks guys so much. We will. I'll see you again hopefully soon for the next installment of something amazing. So you guys take care, and we'll chat with you in the next time.
You as well. Later, thank you, Adam.